Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, September 30th, 2022. There will be no federal government shutdown after the House of Representatives passes a short-term federal government spending bill, joining the Senate, which passed it on Thursday, so it heads to President Biden to be signed into law. Hurricane Ian making a second landfall in South Carolina as a Category 1 as recovery continues in Florida and the devastation caused by Ian there when it was a Category 4. We'll hear from the governors of South Carolina and Florida and from President Biden promising Floridians, we're going to do everything we can for you. Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson attends an investiture, a ceremony welcoming her as the newest justice. The new Supreme Court term starts on Monday. Russian President Vladimir Putin announcing annexation of four regions of Ukraine after what the U.S. and other Western nations call sham referenda orchestrated by Russia. President Putin promising to defend what he now calls Russian land. U.S. responds with additional sanctions against Russia. And the second gentleman of the United States, Doug Emhoff, the first Jewish spouse of a U.S. president or vice president, speaks at a White House Jewish Rosh Hashanah celebration about childhood memories of the Jewish New Year holiday at his grandmother's, and also the importance of fighting anti-Semitism. And we begin with the federal government funding bill called the Continuing Resolution, or CR. It passed the House today after passing the Senate yesterday. And with President Biden's signature, no partial government shutdown. The bill extends current government funding levels from the start of the new fiscal year, tomorrow, October 1st, through December 16th. There's also $12.4 billion in military and other assistance for Ukraine in its war against Russia, and $18.8 billion for U.S. disaster recovery, including hurricanes in the southeast, floods in Kentucky, and wildfires in the west. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Democrat from Florida, is a senior member of the Appropriations Committee, speaking on the floor today.
I rise to support this continuing resolution that will keep our federal government open and deliver the vital services that impact us all. Look no further than Southwest Florida, in my home state, where Hurricane Ian inflicted tragic human loss and massive property damage. While we pray for those who endured Ian's wrath and those who still face it, let's pass this continuing resolution and offer more than well wishes. Thankfully, President Biden declared a major disaster, unleashing extensive federal aid and assistance for the counties hit by Ian. But this CR will allow FEMA and other federal partners to keep assistance flowing to Florida in our time of need, while also aiding those hurting in Puerto Rico, Alaska, New Mexico, and Mississippi. We cannot leave communities behind that are still picking up the pieces from disastrous floods, wildfires and hurricanes, and even basic water system failures. This federal funding bill comes to their rescue by helping to meet long-term housing, infrastructure, and recovery needs. This CR also extends funding for vital federal education, health, housing, and public safety programs. It keeps up school, job training, and child nutritional investments, and it keeps funds flowing to address badly needed affordable housing problems, which plague so many families in Florida. Anyone who understands the housing struggles that millions of Americans face cannot possibly ignore the relief that this CR offers. And this legislation also keeps America's security intact, while also supporting those brave veterans who defended us. This CR also confronts Russia's fake elections to annex parts of Ukraine, whose families urgently need our support to defend global democracy and turn back a murderous communist tyrant. I am pleased that this continuing resolution before us reflects that vanishing breed of bipartisan, bicameral, negotiated compromise. I hope our colleagues on the other side of the aisle respect that and honor the trust that Americans hand us to maintain an orderly economy and state of affairs. This CR provides that basic test of governance. Americans want our government funding bills to help reduce their cost of living, support their families, create good jobs, and combat climate change. This continuing funding legislation gives us the time we need to ensure our 2023 bills will do exactly that. Let's keep America running so Congress can complete America's critical fiscal work.
Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Democrat from Florida, on the House floor. Congressman Ben Klein, Republican from Virginia, also a member of the Appropriations Committee.
I rise on behalf of the people of the 6th District of Virginia who are contacting my office right now, expressing their outrage at this failed do-nothing Democratic majority who has brought us to the brink of a government shutdown. They are furious. Furious because Democrats control the House, the Senate, the White House, and still here we are at the point where we have to keep the government running. And instead of confronting these crises that are leading us to this shutdown, this Democratic majority is kicking the can down the road until after the elections in November. The American people are furious at a broken business as usual Washington that refuses to confront the crises, in fact, exacerbates the crises created by President Biden and the Democrat majority. This continuing resolution we're voting on today once again makes clear that the Democrats' business as usual Washington must end. Just look at some of these policies that Democrats have stuffed in this bill. Thrown taxpayer dollars at Biden's wide-open border crisis, the raging inflation crisis, and the skyrocketing energy crisis. $57.5 billion for DHS to continue wide-open border and amnesty policies that have allowed illegal migrants to pour across our southern border and drug cartels to smuggle deadly fentanyl into our communities under Secretary Mayorkas's failed leadership. $10.8 billion for the FBI that the Biden administration has weaponized against Americans who disagree with its policies, including parents concerned about their kids in schools. $12.6 billion for the IRS, on top of the $80 billion the Democrats just gave to hire 87,000 new agents to spy into the bank accounts of Americans and conduct more audits on small businesses. $728 billion to a Department of Defense that is more focused on promoting the radical left's woke ideology than protecting our national security here at home and abroad. $3.8 billion for a low-income housing energy assistance program that pays for the increased energy costs for those that live in anti-fracking states like New York without addressing the real cause of the energy crisis, which is the Democrats' socialist Green New Deal agenda. Americans are hurting and their paychecks are declining in value, but Democrats continue to fund these out-of-touch policies, and that's why I'm voting no.
Congressman Ben Klein, Republican from Virginia. The House went on to pass this bill funding the federal government for 11 weeks. 230 to 201 was the vote, 10 Republicans joining the Democrats in voting yes. When the Senate passed it on Thursday, the vote there was 72 to 25. 22 Republican senators voted yes. President Biden plans to sign it into law. No government shutdown this year. Now to Hurricane Ian, making the second landfall in South Carolina, a lot weaker than when it was a Category 4 storm slamming into Florida's west coast a couple of days ago. Now it's a Category 1, sustained winds topping out at 85 miles per hour, still plenty of rain and storm surge potential. White House says President Biden and the South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster spoke, and the two discussed the steps the Biden-Harris administration is taking to support South Carolina in preparation for the landfall of Hurricane Ian, including the issuance of an emergency declaration for South Carolina last night. The governor, Henry McMaster, speaking today at a news conference at the Emergency Operations Center in West Columbia.
As I speak, the center of Hurricane Ian is approaching the coast of South Carolina, just above Charleston, mainly from Bulls Bay up through Myrtle Beach. I've spoken to a number of the mayors in those areas, and they are well prepared. The Grand Strand, particularly right now, is seeing very rough seas. Also, behind the Grand Strand, the water is backing up because it can't get out behind the beaches and behind the creeks. But this is not as bad as it could have been. A lot of prayers have been answered, but I would ask people, don't quit yet because it's still coming. We are not out of the woods. I remind people, as John Quirello just said, there's water on the roads. We've seen photographs of it. The people have been sending us, the mayors and others, and it's still very dangerous. And there's still winds even where there's not much water in other parts of the state. So if you don't need to go outside in the wind right now, stay inside. If you don't need to drive anywhere, don't drive. Be careful and be smart.
South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster at a news conference with other state agency officials at the Emergency Ops Center in West Columbia, South Carolina. Back in Florida, there is rescue and recovery of the missing and the victims of the hurricane, plus the massive effort to restore electricity to about 2 million customers. There are boil water notices in effect for several areas dealing with flooding and the storm surge, and generally the cleanup of the piles of the debris the hurricane left behind. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis joined today by the FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell at the Emergency Operations Center in Tallahassee. The governor asked what he needs from the federal government. He was also asked about casualties. You're going to also hear from Kevin Guthrie, Director of Florida's Division of Emergency Management.
Governor, I got two quick ones. First of all, do we have an update on casualties? And second of all, obviously you're meeting with the administrator today. What are you asking for? What does the state of Florida need from FEMA?
Well, I think the number one thing that we needed, you know, that they provided, which was the Army Corps to support Lee County and their water situation. Critical to get that infrastructure back up and running. You look at this storm, you know, obviously there was really significant damage, but you also have a lot of folks who had minimal or maybe no damage, and getting them back, you know, make sure they're in their homes, they have the running water, the electrical, all of that is going to make all the other efforts so much better. So we appreciate that, but I think that is probably the number one priority. Kevin, would you say that that's probably the number one priority? And, you know, the Army Corps, they're the subject matter experts, and so hopefully they get a diagnosis and then they can plan and the county can go in and fix it. I'll let Kevin talk about the other.
So where we stand right now on fatalities is, I'll break this down by county. We have one confirmed fatality in Polk County. We have 12 unconfirmed fatalities in Charlotte County. We have 8 unconfirmed fatalities in Collier County. And we are still processing through the situation with the hasty search that I mentioned before in Lee County. Now, let me talk about confirmation and unconfirmed. People die in disasters that have nothing to do with the disaster, right? So the medical examiner is the one that makes that determination. They are the lead agency at the local level to determine when they investigate that this is either disaster related or not disaster related. If it is determined to be disaster related, you've heard the governor and I talk about this now for about 3 or 4 days, there is a direct death, in other words, storm surge, rising water, things of that nature, or indirect, the stuff that led up to it after the fact. So with that being said, we have 12 unconfirmed fatalities in Charlotte County. We have 8 unconfirmed fatalities in Collier County. We have 1 confirmed fatality in Polk County. So that brings us up to 21 total. We do have an identified situation that was done during the hasty search of some fatalities. We do not know exactly how many were in the house. And let me paint the picture for you. The water was up over the rooftop, right? But we had a Coast Guard rescue swimmer swim down into it, and he could identify that it appeared to be human remains. We do not know exactly how many. We do not know what the situation is. And before we comment on that, we want to be transparent, but we just don't know that number. And we got a couple of other situations where we had that particular type of situation. So right now, the number we're going with is we have 21. We have identified a situation for sure that we know we got something in, but until the water recedes and we get the special equipment, again, we've got to have special equipment to get in there. And as the governor's already talked about, is we can't get that over there. So I'll take just a point of privilege there and talk about that. We've got a 20 by 40 foot spud barge that's now been delivered that we can now start traversing some heavier equipment. In the search of world rescue, this is called Hackneys. These are basically like beer delivery trucks, soda delivery trucks that have specialized equipment that we can get on that spud barge, get it on the land, the other side, and start doing some really technical type of rescue. Once we get to that point, then we can probably give you some better numbers. But where we're at today is 21, 1 confirmed, 20 unconfirmed.
Kevin Guthrie, Director of Florida's Division of Emergency Management, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in Tallahassee this morning. The Tallahassee Democrat newspaper, part of the USA Today network, writes, the Biden administration declared 4 more Florida counties as major disaster areas, meaning tens of thousands of more Florida residents impacted by Hurricane Ian can apply for financial assistance. Administration officials said Friday that Orange, Osceola, Polk, and Seminole counties were declared major disaster areas, and that more may be added in the coming days. The declaration gives the Federal Emergency Management Agency the authorization to directly help individuals in 13 Florida counties pay for temporary housing and home repairs, offer low-interest loans to cover uninsured property losses, and fund other federal programs to assist individuals and business owners recover from one of the nation's biggest storms. President Biden speaking from the White House today about that federal aid as Florida recovers from the hurricane and the other states deal with the impact.
With the devastation caused by Hurricane Ian in Florida and the storm just hours away from hitting South Carolina, some parts are already hit, I want to update you on what we've done since I last spoke to you on this 24 hours ago. I've directed that every possible action be taken to save lives and get help to survivors, because every single minute counts. It's not just a crisis for Florida. This is an American crisis. We're all in this together, and I've spoken to Governor DeSantis on multiple occasions, as well as this morning, and as well as mayors and county officials, both Republican and Democrat, from the places most affected. And I spoke with Governor McMaster of South Carolina this morning as well. Last night, I received a request for an emergency declaration from Governor McMaster, which I approved right away, just as I did for Florida. This allows for immediate federal funding for the state to shelter people and provide other essential support. By approving it early, ahead of the storm's landfall in South Carolina, we can get supplies in and provide shelter if necessary. My message to the people of South Carolina is simple. Please listen to all the warnings and directions from local officials and follow their instructions. And as you all know, the situation in Florida is far more devastating. We're just beginning to see the scale of that destruction. It's likely to rank among the worst of the nation's and the worst in the nation's history. You have all seen on television, homes and property wiped out. It's going to take months, years to rebuild. And our hearts go out to all those folks whose lives have been absolutely devastated by this storm. America's heart is literally breaking just watching people watching on television. I just want the people of Florida to know we see what you're going through and we're with you. We're going to do everything we can for you. I say to the rest of Americans, just imagine yourself in that situation. Water rising, walls collapsing, streets turned literally into rivers, charter boats on top of automobiles, watching the home and the community work so hard to establish, literally washed away. And folks across the country are now waiting to hear from parents and grandparents who live in Florida, just hoping and praying they're okay.
President Biden at the White House. Story at ABC News, President Joe Biden's administration scaling back his federal student loan cancellation program to protect against legal challenges, including two suits filed this week, with new guidelines now excluding at least hundreds of thousands of borrowers initially told they qualified for the forgiveness. On Thursday, the Department of Education quietly updated its instructions on who qualifies for the debt forgiveness program of up to $20,000 for some Americans. The new guidance excludes people who took out federal loans that, while they were guaranteed by the government, were technically handled by private banks. More on this from today's White House briefing with the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
The Education Department yesterday tweaked some eligibility issues with the student loan forgiveness plan that it basically say the borrowers with federal loans that are owned by private banks are now ineligible. It will affect perhaps 770,000 borrowers. I've also seen a couple million. Just curious, is that a disappointment for the White House that you have to make this change, seemingly around some legal issues? And could there be future changes before applications are made that could narrow eligibility further? Or is the plan final now?
So first, I just want to make sure, because I know this was out there, that the number of borrowers impacted or change is much smaller. I know there was a number of millions, but it's actually much smaller. So our goal from day one has always been to deliver relief to many borrowers as possible, as quickly as possible. And this change helps us achieve that. So we will continue to make sure we zero in on that. Look, the Department of Education continues to explore alternative ways to provide relief to those borrowers with commercially held loans. I do want to say that when you think about what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to give relief to everyday Americans, right? We're trying to give relief to working families. We're trying to give relief to working Americans. And the fact that you see folks out there in Republican states that are making it very hard for us to do that, for us to give a little bit of a breathing room to working Americans, I think it's really unfortunate, because what we are doing is actually popular with Americans. What we are doing is actually giving Americans an opportunity to put money down on a house, an opportunity to start a family. And so that is what, unfortunately, we're seeing Republican officials are doing. And remember, this is going to help 40 million Americans who truly, really need just a little bit more space.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with reporters in the White House briefing room. CNN writing on this: borrowers with privately held federal student loans represent a small portion of the 43 million federal student loan borrowers. There are about 4 million borrowers with federal family education loans, but not all of those people are likely eligible for the loan forgiveness plan, which also includes an income requirement. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, asked today about criticism from another House Democrat, Abigail Spanberger of Virginia, over the speaker's not bringing up a bill that bans lawmaker stock trading. Congresswoman Spanberger, in a written statement, "This moment marks a failure of House leadership, and it's yet another example of why I believe that the Democratic Party needs new leaders in the halls of Capitol Hill, as I have long made known."
We have a rather striking statement here from Abigail Spanberger criticizing the Democratic leadership over not calling up the stock bill here. I know that that is just put out the new version just a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
She criticizes the process, but she says it is time for new leadership. What do you say in response to her criticism, but generally going forward as we get after the midterms and people start to wonder whether you're going to be here and other leaders are going to be here in the new Congress?
Which question do you want me to answer? Choose one.
Do you intend to be here in the new Congress as the speaker, as the minority leader?
I'm strictly focused on winning the next election. Do you want to talk about that? Okay, is that your question? Okay. Who's next? And let me just say about Spanberger's letter. First of all, her bill is contained in this bill. Other members had ideas, too, to improve upon the bill. So I didn't see, I don't know what her statement is, but it is contrary to what the House Administration Committee. I said to them, whatever the members want to do, I fully support. And they took her bill, added others that made the bill stronger, as a matter of fact. So this is an interesting press release, but it's more important to write a bill.
What she's saying is she's criticizing the failure to bring it up.
You have to have the votes to bring it up.
And you don't think you have the votes?
Well, we'll see. We'll work to have the vote. We don't go from one day to the next. But I think we should have legislation. There are others who have spoken out against the bill. And again, this is the legislative process. But it is how you described her characterization is not accurate. Her bill is in the bill. Others had ideas, too. And that's what our committee put forth. But it's good press because you asked the question. Anybody else? Yes, ma'am.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at her weekly briefing. She also spoke today about the Supreme Court's special sitting for the investiture of Associate Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. It was a private invitation-only event. President Biden was there, along with First Lady Jill Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff. Associated Press reports that Justice Jackson followed the custom of every other justice since 1972 and sat in a chair that once belonged to John Marshall, who served as Chief Justice for 34 years in the early 1800s. AP adding this, Justice Marshall was also a slaveholder, perhaps adding a special poignancy to Justice Jackson taking her place in his one-time possession. She's only the third black justice in the court's history, along with her colleague Justice Clarence Thomas and the late Justice Thurgood Marshall. She's also the first black woman justice on the court. Ceremony included reading of the proclamation appointing Justice Jackson and her repeating the oath that she took when she formally joined the court back in June. Here again is the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi.
I just came from the Supreme Court, where we, all of us there, witnessed a very historic occasion. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson invested her as the first African-American woman member of the Supreme Court. think there's something like 109 members of the Supreme Court in our country's history, at long last, an African-American woman. It was pretty exciting. The president was there, and of course it was his appointment, and the attorney general's role was to propose that. So it was pretty thrilling.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at her weekly news conference. After the ceremony at the Supreme Court, again, it was not public. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and Chief Justice John Roberts walked out of the court building and down the steps, shaking hands. And then Justice Jackson's husband, Patrick Jackson, came over for a kiss before they walked off. That video is available at cspan.org, our video library. There is no audio. This is from SCOTUS blog. When the justices return to the bench next week to begin the 2022-23 term, members of the public will be able to attend oral arguments for the first time since the COVID-19 pandemic began in 2020. The court also announced that it will continue to provide a live audio feed of oral arguments, a practice that it began during the pandemic. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A story from Reuters: a defiant Vladimir Putin proclaimed Russia's annexation of a swath of Ukraine in a pomp-filled Kremlin ceremony, promising Moscow would triumph in its special military operation against Kyiv, even as some of its troops face potential defeat. The article continues: the Russian president's proclamation of Russia's rule over 15% of Ukraine, the biggest annexation in Europe since World War II, was roundly rejected by Western countries, with the United States and Britain announcing new sanctions. Here's a portion of President Putin's speech.
You know that in Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republic, in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, referenda were held. All the votes were calculated and the outcomes are known. People have made their choice. And this choice is beyond any doubt. Today we are going to sign the treaties on admitting the Donetsk People's Republic, Luhansk People's Republic, Zaporozhye region and Kherson region. I am sure that the Federal Assembly will support constitutional laws on admitting to Russia four new regions, four new constituent entities, because it is the will of millions of people.
Russian President Vladimir Putin at today's ceremony in Moscow. He also said, "We will defend our land with all our strength and all our means." And he called on the Kyiv regime to immediately cease hostilities and return to the negotiation table. And he had this in his speech: sanctions are not enough for the Anglo-Saxons. They have switched to sabotage. In fact, they have begun to destroy the pan-European infrastructure. He appeared to refer to the damage to the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines. In Washington, President Joe Biden responding to all these developments and accusations.
America and its allies are not going, let me emphasize, are not going to be intimidated, are not going to be intimidated by Putin and his reckless words and threats. He's not going to scare us, and he doesn't or intimidate us. Putin's actions are a sign he's struggling. The sham referenda he carried out and this routine he put on, don't worry, it's not on there if you're looking, okay? The sham routine that he put on this morning that's showing the unity and, you know, as people holding hands together. Well, the United States is never going to recognize this. And quite frankly, the world's not going to recognize it either. He can't seize his neighbor's territory and get away with it. It's as simple as that. And they're going to stay the course. They're going to continue to provide military equipment so that Ukraine can defend itself and its territory and its freedom, including additional resources that the Congress is going to give me today of $13 billion more dollars to help the Ukrainians defend themselves and fight back. And we're fully prepared to defend. I want to say this again. America is fully prepared with our NATO allies to defend every single inch of NATO territory. Every single inch. So, Mr. Putin, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Every inch. And I have to be, I've been in close touch with our allies. We're announcing new sanctions today as well, that including new authorities to sanction anyone who provides political or economic support to Russia's fraudulent territorial claims. And I've been in close touch with our NATO allies, who are united in our resolve to take on his aggression. So I thank you all very much. You also asked me earlier about the pipeline, and let me say this. It was a deliberate act of sabotage, and now the Russians are pumping out disinformation and lies. We're going to work with our allies to get to the bottom exactly precisely what happened. And as at my direction, I've already begun to help our allies enhance the protection of this critical infrastructure. And at the appropriate moment, when things calm down, we're going to be sending divers down to find out exactly what happened. We don't know that yet exactly, but we're not, just don't listen to what Putin is saying. What he's saying, we know is not true.
President Biden at the White House today. Ukrainian Minister of Foreign Affairs Dmytro Kuleba tweeting, by attempting to annex Ukraine's Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson regions, President Putin tries to grab territories he doesn't even physically control on the ground. Nothing changes for Ukraine. We continue liberating our land and our people, restoring our territorial integrity. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also saying today the U.S. will never recognize what he calls President Putin's land grab. And Secretary Blinken talking about the new sanctions and U.S. action at the United Nations.
I also made clear that when Russia made this move, the United States and our allies and partners would impose swift and severe costs on individuals and entities inside and outside of Russia that provide political or economic support to illegal attempts to change the status of Ukrainian territory. Today, we've done just that in coordination with the European Union, and Canada is taking similar steps as well. We're also issuing a clear warning supported by G7 leaders. We will hold to account any individual, entity, or country that provides political or economic support for President Putin's illegal attempts to change the status of Ukrainian territory. In support of this commitment, the Departments of the Treasury and Commerce are releasing new guidance on heightened sanctions and export control risks for entities and individuals inside and outside of Russia that support in any way the Kremlin's sham referenda, purported annexation, and occupation of parts of Ukraine. We're also taking action today at the United Nations Security Council to hold Russia accountable for the sham referenda and the purported annexations. If Russia blocks the Security Council from carrying out its responsibilities, we'll ask the UN General Assembly, where every country has a vote, to make clear that it's unacceptable to redraw borders by force. Every country has a stake in condemning these steps.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the State Department in Washington, a joint news conference with the visiting Canadian foreign minister. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky saying today his country will file an expedited application to join NATO after the Russian president signed those treaties to annex parts of Ukraine. President Zelensky saying, de facto, we have already proven interoperability with the alliance's standards. They are real for Ukraine, real on the battlefield and in all respects for air interaction. He said it's time to make it legal, de jure, through those expedited procedures. This is Washington Today. A 7.5-foot tall bronze statue of former President Harry S. Truman on top of a 3-foot pedestal has been unveiled in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda, the newest addition to the National Statuary Hall collection, comprised of 100 statues, 2 from each state. The statue of Harry Truman comes from Missouri, his home state. He was a U.S. Senator from Missouri before becoming Vice President and then President from 1945 through 52. The ceremony on Thursday included remarks from the bipartisan House and Senate leadership, along with a House member and senator from Missouri, again, bipartisan. And from the family, here is Clifton Truman Daniel, honorary chair of the Truman Library Institute.
My grandfather was a modest man and, frankly, slightly embarrassed by statues. His presidential library is an educational institution rather than a monument to him. But were he with us today, he would be honored and humbled. He loved the United States of America. He loved the work of government. He loved this very building. He took the job seriously, but never himself. He was open and approachable, as Tom Corbin's excellent statue depicts. He has been called an uncommon, common man. Of all his accomplishments, the Marshall Plan, NATO, the Truman Doctrine, the desegregation of the armed services, I think the most significant was reminding us that a farmer, a citizen soldier, a small businessman can rise to the highest office in this land and do a better job of it than almost anybody else. That is the promise of this nation, the promise that that same ability lives within each one of us. He did what he did for the greater good, not the greater glory. He always said that it was amazing how much you could get done if you didn't care who got the credit. His favorite epitaph in Tombstone, Arizona reads, "Here lies Jack Williams. He done his damnedest." He was an honest, hard-working, empathetic, and sensible human being. And I leave you today with my family's deep gratitude and a quote that illustrates those qualities in my grandfather. Do your duty, and history will do you justice. Thank you.
Clifton Truman Daniel, honorary chair of the Truman Library Institute, grandson of former President Harry S. Truman, in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda on Thursday at the statue unveiling. Cost of the statue, $400,000, paid for by private donations. Harry S. Truman is the 10th presidential statue in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. As mentioned, each state gets to donate two statues, and the Missouri legislature voted to install Harry S. Truman to replace a statue of Thomas Hart Benton, a five-term U.S. senator from Missouri that was put there in 1899. A Jewish New Year reception today at the White House. At this time between the Rosh Hashanah holiday itself, that was the start of this week, and the upcoming Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, which will be next week. Attending today's event, President Biden and the Vice President Kamala Harris and their spouses. The second gentleman, Doug Emhoff, talking about his groundbreaking accomplishment, being the first Jewish spouse of a president or vice president. Then a little bit about memories of his childhood with his grandmother. And then seriousness on the importance of freedom of religion.
And it's a particular honor for me as the first Jewish spouse of a president or a vice president. But do you know, for years, as a lot of you know, the Bidens invited our community for celebrations when they lived at the vice president's residence. Yeah. And now the vice president, Harris, and I, my wife, are we are very grateful that we get to continue in the tradition that they set forth. The doorposts there are protected by mezuzot, that's two mezuzas. We hosted a Passover Seder. We've lit a historic menorah for Hanukkah. But now we gather in the White House during the days of awe, as Dr. Biden mentioned, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Now, in my family, Rosh Hashanah meant a trip to my grandmother's apartment in Brooklyn. And I could still smell that brisket cooking and burning in the kitchen. I can still taste the slightly warm challah, but slightly stale, on the table. And of course, as a lot of you remember, my grandmother begged all of us kids not to jump on the couch because I took the plastic coverings off. But this is also a season to reflect and atone and repent for both of our shortcomings and those that we see around us. And let's be clear, we all know this. Jews worldwide face horrendous discrimination and violence and anti-Semitism. And one of the reasons that our great president ran for president was to confront the kinds of hate and anti-Semitism that we all saw and were mortified by in Charlottesville. And on this issue, we have a president and a vice president who know that all Americans must be able to worship without fear, or violence. And we also know they are two leaders of deep faith who believe in tolerance and inclusion, not just for our Jewish community, but for all communities.
Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff at today's Rosh Hashanah celebration, the Jewish New Year, in the White House East Room. You can find the full video, including remarks by President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden at cspan.org. And the White House says the president held a conference call later in the day with over 1,200 rabbis and clergy members from around the country, during which he reaffirmed his longstanding commitment to and leadership on issues of importance to the American Jewish community. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word to get the stories Washington is talking about sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.